Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this podcast. This episode is a very special conversation with Mohammed Shehada. Listeners to the Torah Sheikh will be familiar with Mohammed. He is one of the best writers and commentators and communication specialists around, as well as a proud Palestinian. And he breaks down what's happening within European politics, as well as the latest from on the ground in Gaza. If you like what we do, if you enjoy the podcast, if you enjoy the podcast, please help us keep going. We have no ads. We have no sponsors. We rely entirely on you across the Torah Sheikh, whether it be on the podcast, Reboot Republic, Echo Chamber, Fresh Batch, Muse Cult, or all of the others that make up our little independent media platform. The easiest way to support us is by clicking the link that says patreon.com/Torah Sheikh. It is at the top of the podcast you're listening to right now. So while you're listening, why don't you give us the 30 seconds it'll take you to join us and help keep these conversations going. Thanks for liking, sharing, letting people know where to find us. Love to see you on the Patreon. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to PALcast, a podcast brought to you by Yusuf Al-Jamal here in Istanbul, Helena Coban from Washington, D.C., and Tony Groves from Dublin. It's April 2nd, 4 p.m. here in Istanbul, and I'm very delighted to have Mohammed Shehada, who is a friend from Gaza, but also a writer and an expert on Palestinian and Gazan affairs. We're going to talk about the recent developments in Gaza and the killing of 7 international aid workers working for the World Central Kitchen by an Israeli strike in Deir el-Balah yesterday, as well as the total destruction of Shifa hospitals. Mohammed, Tony, and Helena, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Perfect. Mohammed, you know, you've been writing about Palestinian affairs and the situation in Gaza, warning that, you know, something will happen, that the situation in Gaza is not sustainable. Placing Gaza under siege is not sustainable for many years and for many publications. And I've been reading your writings and following you on Twitter and seeing how your readership has grown over the years. But it seems that European leaders, even with the killing of 7 international aid workers, many of them are European, are not listening.
Yeah, well, basically, I've been traveling around Europe, meeting different civil servants, diplomats, officials, and high-level and mid-level. And the impression I got is that there are 3 kinds of people. Number one, there are people that do not know, they don't want to know, and simply don't care. They're too ignorant that it becomes embarrassing. You feel sorry for them. So at some point, I was in Berlin meeting someone works at the desk of Israel-Palestine. And basically, he says that while we were having lunch, he said it very candidly. He said, I believe the only reason Israel maintains an occupation is security. So I said, yeah, I know 500,000 settlers who would disagree with you. You couldn't convince the guy otherwise. He believed that point, and he simply didn't care. He didn't want to learn. He didn't want to know. Then there was the other kind, and surprisingly, those were very senior officials. So we went to meet a top official in the Foreign Ministry of Germany. I had the same interaction with other officials across Europe and some in the U.S. as well. The guy was very decent. He knew, he was extremely knowledgeable. He knew almost everything that's happening in Gaza. He agreed with virtually everything we said. He did not dispute anything. The apartheid, the genocide, the siege on Gaza, war crimes, crimes against humanity. He didn't dispute any of it. He even went a step further when one of the people in the room told him that, yeah, Germany has been on Israel's good side for a long time. You've been very supportive of them, so they would listen to you if you whisper into their ears. And that senior officially responded by saying, no, whispering in their ears doesn't work. They never listen. They get very angry as soon as we try. So it's counterproductive. So he agreed with everything, and he was critical, very, very critical on what's happening. The problem is he wouldn't say a single word of that publicly. And he was very honest about that he's not going to say any of that publicly. Then there is the third kind of officials who know what's happening and are very intimately familiar with everything that's happening, but would openly gaslight with so much malevolence and so much, I would say, dehumanization, if not pure racism, that it becomes very striking. So the minister in Germany herself, Annalena Baerbock, she campaigned on what is called feminist-led foreign policy, human rights-led foreign policy, as Germany's foreign minister. She travels to Israel at the same time that women in Gaza were having their uteruses removed, women in their 20s having their uteruses removed to stop post-birth bleeding, and were having C-sections without anesthesia. And she goes after meeting with Benny Gantz, you have Gallant, the Israeli defense minister and war minister. She goes on Twitter. She didn't stay silent. She didn't say it in passing. She writes it on Twitter for the whole world to read. She writes, "I deeply believe that Israel cares passionately about the civilian population of Gaza. This is what distinguishes the deep humanity of Israel from the enemies they are fighting in Hamas." So there is this psychopathic level. And those basically were the three kinds of officials that you can come across. Either people who don't want to know, or people that are outright malevolent, or people that know but are totally powerless and can't do anything about it.
So that's really fascinating, Mohammed. Thank you so much for sharing that really concise understanding of what's happening in Europe. I feel, you know, sitting here in Washington, D.C., there's something similar amongst members of Congress and people who work in the administration. We recently had another resignation from somebody who worked at the State Department over Gaza, but very, very few people in, you know, the State Department or DOD. Of course, there was the wonderful young man from the Air Force who self-immolated, Aaron Bushnell, and there is another young man from the Air Force who is on a hunger strike, a serving airman. But those people are so rare and so far between. What are you able to do in terms of reaching out with European civil society? I see these massive, great demonstrations throughout Europe. Is civil society able to do anything more than just be on the street?
Yeah, well, we've seen, I think, unprecedented campaigning on the street, as you said, for instance, in Denmark or in the UK or different parts of Europe. You've seen numbers that are quite unprecedented in many ways. The only problem is that you're dealing with politicians that have insulated themselves with multiple layers of deflection and defense and dehumanization. And they all have their reasons. So once you talk to them personally, it would be something like, yeah, I'm going to lose my job if I say this publicly. Or, yeah, we need to say what pleases Israel in order to influence them better. Or with elected officials, it becomes even more corrupt and even more despairing. I would say at the same time, we see civil society intimidating those politicians to, like, occasionally pretend to do something. So early on in the war, you wouldn't have any European official saying the word ceasefire, and you wouldn't have them speaking about Gaza in any positive terms at all. It was the same message over and over again of saying that Israel has the right to defend itself, but in accordance with international law. And when we talk to them in private, they present this statement as something benevolent and generous and kind and supportive of Palestinians, that they add the qualifier in accordance with international law, to which I always responded, this is even worse than just staying silent. Because every time you tell the Israelis, yeah, you have the right to defend yourself in accordance with international law, they only understand it as you have the right to defend yourself. Because for the Israeli leadership, the defense establishment, and the public, they all take for granted that, of course, we are in accordance with international law. Of course, we're doing everything by the book. We're doing nothing wrong. Now, you saw it on display at the ICJ, for example. The Israeli defense team were so indignant, genuinely indignant. They were not faking it. You can see it on their faces. They were so angry, irritated, and hostile. They were in shock. They couldn't believe that Israel can be accused by any insinuation that it's breaking international law. That's the bubble they live in. But that was the case early on in the war. Officials saying, yeah, Israel has the right to defend itself in accordance with international law. With mounting pressure, you see these rhetorics changing and improving gradually. Not enough, but they are improving. So now, if you follow the public discourse in the US or across Europe, politicians can, there are things they cannot get away with if they use the genocide word or apartheid word, but they can be pretty harsh on Israel in two aspects at the moment: the Rafah operation and humanitarian aid. Of course, the US sets the line for that and Europe follows, but there in these two aspects alone, you can get a lot of critical and nuanced thoughts. And I don't think we would have gotten to that level without the pressure that is being exerted on the ground, that you now have politicians openly criticizing and telling Israel, don't go into Rafah, and you should allow aid to go in, and challenging the Israeli propaganda, because Israel keeps saying that, yeah, we are flooding, that is the word, we are flooding Gaza with aid. Never seen anything psychopathic to that extent. It's so shameless gaslighting. But you see European and American officials now responding to this critically and not falling for it and not just repeating empty propaganda. But unfortunately, it's only on these two issues, the humanitarian aid and Rafah. Bring up Khan Yunis or Shifa Hospital or Gaza City, it doesn't exist. So I would say that this has been the result of civil society pressure, and we need to keep it up in order to get them to be more critical on other topics as well.
Just to make a point on the, UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese making the point that, you know, rhetoric without action is meaningless. And that kind of was, not even a thinly veiled dig. It was a real dig at Irish politicians, for example, who've said a lot of things, but, you know, failed to actually take concrete steps. And now we see Ireland will add its imprimatur to the South African case in the ICJ, for example, but we don't know what they're going to say quite yet. But nonetheless, there's some steps. And then the other side of that, when you look at it within the European context, Mohammed, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this, is there is still quite hostile divisions within the media. I mean, did you see the question put to the same UN Special Rapporteur, asking her from a German journalist, had she seen a document that said Israel intended to commit genocide? It's quite strange to see the media has also not moved in lockstep with where perhaps the streets are.
Yeah, it is. It's incredible. What's even more incredible in Germany, I've never seen such concerted effort at disinformation by omission and literal brainwashing. So yesterday, there was a friend sent me a picture from an average metro station in Berlin. It on a screen with the announcements, it said Israel kills 9,000 terrorists in Gaza. Who on earth would care about such a thing while taking a metro in Berlin? But the interesting thing is that this screen announcement, it coincided with Haaretz itself saying that the number 9,000 is bullshit. It's basically Israel counts into that 9,000 tally any Palestinians that are killed into areas that are called extermination zones. Extermination zones. So anybody killed there is a terrorist. The other dimension, as I said, the disinformation by omission. So My colleagues and friends and I, we get contacted nonstop. I deliberately use the phrase waste because I mean it in that sense. I waste a lot of time, an incredible amount of time, responding to journalists from top publications around Europe, the US, and around the world. We basically, me and colleagues and friends here and there, we do the work for them because none of them have access to Gaza. So, for instance, a journalist would write us and ask, can you send me a list of the bakeries that Israel bombed in Gaza? Which days? Which areas? What times? Why? What's the pretext? What was the extent of the damage? I need photographic evidence. I need witness testimony. And we give them everything. Just hand it to them on a silver plate for them to present it as their own work. And then it never gets published. It's like, yeah, there's an editorial decision. Yeah, we decided to withhold this piece until a later point. Yeah, there is something more urgent. Nah, the excuses, they never run out of them. But I've never seen that extent where You basically, they know what's happening. You provided all the information. They verified it. They were very pleased with it. They come to you over and over again, but they never publish. And the other dimension is once they publish and you manage to make that breakthrough, you manage to fight for every word, every sentence, they use a language that is so incredibly dry and dull. It's very technical, very tedious, very robotic, as opposed to the sort of very emotional and sensationalist coverage when anything has to do with Israel or Israelis. And you can see it even in the basic terms of children. There are no two people would dispute that a child is a child. But in international mainstream media, you read an Israeli child, a Palestinian under the age of 18. I've never seen anything like this. There's also the atmosphere of intimidation that I would say is very widespread in the media. So I have friends, journalists in prominent publications. One of them, he told me, and he works for, it's considered center-left or liberal or left, international outlet, a very giant one, very well-reputed, progressive one. I would say centrist after the Gaza coverage, if not right-wing. But anyways, so that person, he says that he made a video on Gaza early on in the war, after which the editor-in-chief summoned him to the office and gave him two ultimatums. Don't write a single word about Gaza again. Stop your YouTube channel immediately. And he had to threaten that he's going to quit, he's going to leave. And then it worked out. He didn't lose the job, and they didn't succeed with pressuring him.
Muhammad, but I see also there's an Israeli audacity in committing crimes. Over the past week, we have this video by Jazeera where Israeli snipers killed two Palestinians in these extermination zones that you mentioned, and they buried them. And the footage is there. They said, oh, as usual, you know, we're going to investigate that. And soon after, they invaded a Shifa hospital, and they destroyed the hospital completely, killed 300 Palestinians, burned every single house around the hospital, and arrested over, I believe, 500 Palestinians. We've seen images of bodies on the ground of all ages around a Shifa hospital. You know, well-documented crimes against Palestinians. And at the same time, the following day, they're not done. You know, they just killed seven aid workers, international aid workers, with two airstrikes in Deir al-Balah. And just yesterday, they targeted the Iranian embassy in Damascus. So how does it feel? I've been, you know, following you on Twitter, and you've been exposing these crimes one after another with names and debunking Israeli claims. But it doesn't seem that, you know, despite this, some European American condemnation, shy condemnation, let me put it this way, they're not seem to be bothered enough. They're continuing with their crimes and doing things that is literally driving the Middle East into a regional war.
Yeah, precisely. At Al-Shifa Hospital, as you said, many of the bodies were found yesterday were decomposed, flattened by tanks, crushed by tanks that drove back and forth over them, or just hacked into pieces. Many of them were zip-tied and executed. Some of them were blindfolded. The bodies were left at the scene in that state deliberately, because maybe to create an enormous shock amongst Palestinians, but mainly because soldiers, Israeli soldiers, know that they can get away with anything. Some of the bodies were missing limbs or flesh because dogs have been biting at them, which means Israeli soldiers were sitting at the hospital for 2 weeks, witnessing in front of their eyes dogs biting away at the flesh of dead Palestinians that they murdered, and they just let it happen because they know there are no consequences, and they know mainstream media is not going to report on it. We're not going to find a Jack Tapper segment for 9 minutes of this emotional outpouring of his heart out about the barbarity and savagery of Israeli soldiers in Gaza. It's not there. And you're not going to find a single government that's going to say that this is a step too far. The best that we can hope for is a European or American official saying that Israel should investigate we are going to wait for an Israeli investigation into the incident. That is seen as the utmost condemnation possible. So there is a sense that they can get away with anything, which is why in this war in Gaza, I personally lived through 10 Israeli military operations. I think the same for you, Yusuf. Three of them were wars, two were grand invasions. I've never seen the like of this before. Never. Not 1% of it in terms of scale, magnitude, severity, and sheer cruelty. And in many instances, Israeli officers recently, an Israeli officer admitted to Haaretz, said that cruelty is the point. We can destroy Hamas if that was the goal. We can destroy it with 10% of the damage we inflicted on Gaza. But he says, nah, cruelty is the point here.
Yeah, I think, Mohammed, you're quite right. I have written since the beginning that the Israelis seem to be unhinged, seem to be mentally deranged. But now I think you're right. It's very deliberate and it has a number of different motivations. One is you get obviously the Israeli fighters on the ground who are posting these victory, these very, very cruel and joyous victory videos on their social media, and they are allowed and encouraged to do so. So, you know, it's part of like keeping the home front, really thinking that the war is succeeding and it's all good, wonderful fun, like killing Palestinians, which is itself a terrible commentary on the state of Israeli Jewish society right now. But it's also a very classical colonial punishment campaign. You know, I grew up in England, and the whole history of England was, you know, we had to punish the Afghans, we had to punish the Indians, we had to punish the Kenyans, we had to punish the Malays, you know. But you know, and they give maybe some broad outline of how many villages they destroyed. They don't write about, you know, in the written record or in the photographic record about how many women they raped, how many hospitals they destroyed. Now you have the social media. So, you know, that kind of gives us much more of an idea of the evidence of what's happening. And of course, yeah, Tony, they did the same in Ireland. Sorry to forget about what the English did in Ireland.
You're all right.
But so what's going to, like, at the global level, people understand. It's only in the Western media bubble that people are kind of acting in the way that you're describing. Or am I wrong?
Yeah, well, basically, the Israeli propaganda, it used to be sophisticated. It used to put a lot of thought in there. Nowadays, it's not anymore. It's very self-exposed, very weak and fragile, that it becomes laughable. And the point there is that they're not trying to convince. They're just trying to create confusion and trying to tire people out, which is something that I heard from people that are not very emotionally invested in this conflict. Even European civil servants or diplomats say that, yeah, my friends, family, relatives, early on in the war, they were paying a lot of attention. Then there were all these conflicting narratives about each and every single incident that they gave up. They said, it's too complicated. Let's move on. And that's what you see as the goal here, is just to tire people out. There's not any investment anymore in trying to hide out what's happening. But I think that The atrocity that unfolded yesterday that Yusuf alluded to, the seven workers with the World Central Kitchen, that is by far the ultimate one by far since the war started, not in terms of cruelty, but in terms of the details of it, that it was so impossible that by scoring that point, Israel broke a new record in pure barbarity. Because here, since the war started, it's a friend that told me she works at the European Commission. She said, yeah, well, every time something so ugly happens, I say, this is it. Now Ursula von der Leyen is going to say something. Now Joseph Borrell will say something. Now things will change. So especially when that child, Hind, was stuck in a vehicle and an Israeli tank right next to it executed the whole family, and then Hind, and then two ambulance men that they just blew into pieces with tank shells. That woman at the European Commission, she said, yeah, this is it. This is going to be the moment. It was not. And she was like, yeah, the Sheikh Hospital is going to be the moment. It was not. She basically said to me, there is no moment that's going to do anything. But yesterday's incident, it was so magnificent in its details, because here you have an organization that's very friendly to Israel, World Central Kitchen. The CEO of it, Jose Andres, he made a statement enormously supportive of Israel early on in the war. You couldn't get even more supportive than that. It sounded like something that Biden would say or Trump would say. Very, very supportive of Israel. Israel wants the World Central Kitchen to come to Gaza to replace UNRWA, to take over the role of UNRWA. And they're coordinating with them their activities on the ground. They know where the warehouses of the World Central Kitchen are. They know which vehicles they are driving. They know which trucks they are driving, when and where. And they designate specific routes for them to drive on. And they were in Deir al-Balah, a safe zone, not a combat zone. There are no hostilities going on there, except for the Israeli airstrikes that are everywhere in Gaza. But basically, with everything that I just said, what you had yesterday is a convoy of three vehicles from the World Central Kitchen going out on the beach, on a road on the beach in Deir al-Balah. Israel bombs the first one. The survivors in that vehicle, they run to the second vehicle, and they make a phone call informing their superiors that they were just attacked. Then, about a couple of hundred meters away, Israel bombs the second vehicle. The survivors in that vehicle, they make it to the third vehicle, and it drives actually a few hundred meters more, and Israel bombs it. Very methodical, very surgical, no survivors, no witnesses. Every single person in that convoy was killed. And the Israeli narrative to justify it was, there was an armed policeman guarding the aid truck. Therefore, we designated that armed policeman a legitimate target and decided to bomb not the truck, but the three cars that were escorting the truck after the truck had left already. Like, so bizarre, so insane, that it's very much in accordance with what Israel has been trying to deliver as a message to people in Gaza very explicitly, that nothing is safe, no place is safe, and no one is safe. And they get away with it, which is why they're very explicit and honest about it.
Just on the actual reporting, you're absolutely spot on. Three separate attacks on that convoy, and they made sure that they killed everyone. And not only did they do that, but then they've also started this security pretext, as you said, about the armed policemen. But in advance of that, everybody has to know that Israel knew the coordinates of the journey, what was taking place, who was there. All of that was known to them. So there's absolutely no hiding place. And they have, I'm just sick of hearing the lies. But I will say on one thing, though, we have seen, the likes of Elon Levy losing his job for lying on Twitter to people. So we have seen some movement like that. But again, it's funny, they can lie all they want, but they just got in trouble because he lied to a particular British politician at the time. That was the only reason that he got any, I stood down at all. So yeah, thanks for that, Mohammed.
Yeah,
and I think with Elon Levy, it was not lying about David Cameron that got him down. It was Sarah Netanyahu, because he participated in the demonstration against her husband. They also gave two more reasons. They said he mocked Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah. He mocked Hassan Nasrallah at a point where Israel is trying to de-escalate in the north. And the second reason was he applied for Dancing with the Stars without permission.
Oh, no.
It was just all just very fragile pretext. But it was Sarah that got him fired in the first place. I don't think there are any consequences for lying.
So celebrity genocide now.
Yes, exactly.
Unbelievable.
Something like that. But I have to also note that last week, obviously, in spite of everything that we knew up until last Thursday or Friday, President Joe Biden passed through his administration this massive new arms shipment to Israel, and there are no consequences for the Israelis whatsoever, and there will not be until these policies here in Washington, D.C. are changed. I have no idea how that's going to happen, but it has to happen.
Yeah, precisely. I think the closer we get to the elections, the more they feel the heat. The problem is that I heard it from some American former officials and some officials who say that, Biden still underestimates and believes that he is safe and secure despite all the protest votes by Muslims and Arabs and pro-Palestinians in the U.S. They say that he can still win without Michigan, or he can still pull a win with a thin majority in Michigan. So they still hold to the deluded thoughts that there would be no consequences for them as well. But I think the resignations that we're seeing in the State Department, and hopefully also in the Department of Defense and others, are very, very crucial at this moment. I have a friend in Gaza, Ibrahim. He was someone that I used to look up to because he's a computer programmer. He used to make a decent income. He was an exception, like one of the handful of people in Gaza that used to make a decent income because he used to work online, freelancing, as a programmer. Early on in the war, Israel, they bombed his parents' home. In his home, they burned it to the ground. He's now left destitute in Rafah, in the refugee camps, with a child that's 3 years old and his wife. At some point, I was talking to Ibrahim, and he brought up something that was so random, so insignificant, that made it extremely remarkable for me. He said, but he brought it up spontaneously. He said, but you know what? There is this CIA official that put the Palestinian flag as her profile picture on Facebook. At the time, that was a story in the Financial Times. She got in trouble just for putting a Palestinian flag on a Facebook profile. But for him, it resonated. He was like, yeah, things are changing. Things are going to turn around. The world is waking up. And that measure, no matter how insignificant it was, for someone that is in so much desperation, in so much pain, the least glimmer of hope means life or death. Which is why I think these resignations and people speaking up is very incredibly crucial at this point. I know that people at the cabinet office, at the foreign office in the UK, and I heard it from diplomats, I know that people there were crying early on in the war, and some are still out of pure frustration of the leadership just ignoring them repeatedly. It's the same, I heard it from diplomats in the EU. In Germany, some of my interlocutors, including some senior, very senior officials at the foreign ministry, they say that they've been screaming at their TVs and phones a lot. So you see the frustration is there, but without speaking up, I think now is the only time. Otherwise, it's meaningless.
Thank you very much, Mohammed, for joining us today and for your insights and very thoughtful discussions about Gaza, very tragic, a place that we call home. Mohammed and I left Gaza together almost a week apart in 2016. We're still outside Gaza and watching genocide taking place there. And these places, Shifa Hospital and every single place in Gaza means a lot of memories for us. Thank you again for joining us, and I'm going to carry on this conversation with my co-host, Helena Coben of Just Word Educational, and Tony Groves of the Tortoise Track podcast. Tony, you've seen how Israel has been reckless and careless about the way they perpetuate their crimes in Gaza, and commit these crimes, and as if there is no international community, no countries in the region, no people, like as if they commit these crimes in complete darkness. No one knows about them, one after another. And every day it's getting worse. I was shocked when I saw a Shifa hospital. I was just, chatting with my mom, and she told me that she couldn't sleep last night after she saw a Shifa hospital, because these are not just buildings. These are memories for us, for people in Gaza and people who attend to the hospital, the dialysis the department, the, surgical operations department. They were put on fire, and no human being with minimum decent human behavior would do this.
Yusuf, 6 months ago, we thought they'd never bomb a hospital. And they denied that they bombed the hospital. They said it was a misfired rocket. Now they're burning hospitals. Now they're slaughtering people with inside hospitals. And then they're saying that somehow medical professionals were responsible for their own deaths because they failed to acknowledge that Shifa Hospital was the command center for Hamas. These are statements that are still being made, as if, you know, and so there is no level that they seem to want to go to. It reminds me very much of the old, and Helena, you'd be aware, I think it was Steve Bannon came out with it, the flood the zone with shit, just if you keep from one scandal to the next, except for this is much, much worse. This is atrocity to the next. This isn't, you know, Trump sleeping with a porn star and then cheating on his taxes and stuff. This is life and death. And we see it now whereby, you know, let's remember the World Kitchen attack, that was based on a jetty that was being built to bring them in, that was being built out of the rubble that still contained the blood of dead Palestinians. That's the reality. And it's taken us only 6 months to go from they wouldn't do this to now they'll actually build on the bones of the dead. And we just have, I don't know how much of our humanity we've lost in this last 6 months, but I'm constantly, I was fortunate to bump into Daniel Mate the other evening, who was talking about, instead of, someone asked him about hope, and he said he didn't like hope. He liked possibility. And I thought that struck me. He said, living in what's possible. And what's possible right now are, it seems to be, there's two things we can do. More and more barbarity is possible, but it's also possible that we can stop this and come. And I do think that's where, to go back to Muhammad's point, I do think there is slight little changes. But Helena, you're the real downer when you say another 18 billion worth of aid signed off on, which is, you know, a weird way of saying bombs, money for bombs. So I don't know. I'm a bit downhearted today. And I will stitch in. You'll hear also from a UN Special Rapporteur, Mary Lawler, at the end of this, and some of the reasons why I'm a bit down. You'll also hear from her. So yeah, I've no good news, but I'd like to think there's possibility.
Yeah, I think if there's a possibility, Tony, we have to do, we who are part of the white world have to do what we can. But I think the possibility very speedily will come from the global majority of people who are not white. I mean, Irish people, you're kind of exceptional in so many ways, but especially because you are a white country that was colonized. So, you know, you are like the representative of the previously colonized within white Western society. So that's a big thing, for a big role for your country to play. But the global majority is not white. The global majority is previously colonized. They understand, they look at what's happening in Gaza, what the Israelis are doing in Gaza, and it's very familiar to what colonial powers did, you know, all around the world. Including, did you know that Barack Obama's grandfather was actually locked up in a concentration camp by the British in the days of the Mau Mau? You know, people who are part of those societies have those deep folk memories which resonate with Gaza. So I think we're going to have to see the global majority come forth and challenge the white hegemony. And that's what gives me a sense of possibility.
Very well said.
Absolutely. And I have seen a statement, read a statement put out by Palestinian Americans from Gaza, saying they're not going to attend the White House annual Ramadan iftar, which is perfect and reasonable and logical, but also planning and suggesting that they're going to boycott every single Muslim who's going to go to the iftar. And, you know, we have to understand the context here. As Tony said, sending $18 billion to Israel means $18 billion of weapons that they're going to be used against Palestinians, and not just Palestinians, international aid workers who were killed in Gaza. And then you see all these condemnations. So we have countries that shyly condemn, countries that do not condemn at all, but we still have these condemnations. And then at the same time saying, we, like the US saying, we will make sure that our money is not used, or we expect Israel that not to use these weapons and this money to kill civilians. So we have two realities, providing them with support and aid and political support and weapons, and then making empty statements.
The other bit of hope, I suppose, and maybe again, I have to back away from the word hope and think of what's possible. What's also possible is what is 500,000 people on the streets in Jerusalem over the weekend. They're not going to be friends of Palestine overnight, but they're calling for the end of that government that is the most right-wing government. They've decided now that the families of the people who are taken hostage, they've decided no more waiting around, and that movement has the possibility of ending political careers within Israel, which may bring about other changes that can necessitate proper dialogue, because you can't negotiate with the Netanyahu government. And we've seen, they are now under pressure whereby, I mean, they had to put on extra trains to get people onto the streets. And I did see one, I think I mentioned this previously, I did see one poster that's popping up all over the place in different guises. You know, how many starving children will it take to satisfy our hunger? And I think there is a small element within of what's possible there, Helena.
Yeah, actually, I have a real fear that Netanyahu, who sees all these, threats to his continued occupation of the prime ministership, he looks as though he is trying to escalate, he and Gallant and Gantz, all his war cabinet, all his warmongering cabinet, look as though they're actually escalating against Iran with an idea of, the wagging the dog, to deflect the popular anger away from Netanyahu's misdeeds and get us into another big war, because, that's what Jewish Israeli Zionist society loves. It's how they were built. They were built on war. And, another great war, all these like bunker buster bombs and such that Biden signed off on, they don't need those in Gaza, but they could use them very nicely against Hezbollah and against Syria and against Iran. That's my fear.
Yeah, and you're not wrong, because the minute this is over, it's Netanyahu's last day in government. So he has to, maybe his last day before he has to go in front of a judge. So yeah, you're right about that as well. Yusuf, what else are you hearing from Gaza this week before we wrap this?
I mean, the situation is the same. Israel has been bombing non-stop in Rafah and Deir al-Balah and Musayyarat, shooting people and killing people who are trying to move from the north to the south. They burnt the entire area around the Shifa Hospital, killed hundreds of people, including, figures in the Palestinian society. There are four sisters from Shawa family. Four of them are doctors. In their 70s and 80s, they retired. They were killed in their home around the Shifa Hospital. The grandmother of my friend Rana Becker was also killed in her home around the Shifa Hospital. So there are more atrocities. We're learning about more atrocities. I saw a picture of a Palestinian woman who was sniped down by an Israeli soldier. Her son was looking for her for days. She went missing, and then he found her body. Bodies of children and men and women decomposing, as Muhammad said, being eaten by dogs, stray dogs, and Israeli soldiers intentionally allowing them to do that. So it's like multiple layers of crimes. Palestinians are learning about these crimes, and the Shifa Hospital now has been completely destroyed, cannot be reused again. And Israel did this intentionally. So they're destroying any hope of a place and, a city that could be livable. And they've been targeting, Shifa Hospital. And we have warned early in the genocide that if the world allows Israel to storm a Shifa Hospital, then it will be an example. And this is what we've seen, in different hospitals in the north of Gaza. There is no functioning hospital now at all. And I think they will move on and target other hospitals the way they targeted Shifa Hospital, unfortunately, because the word is silent. They're just asking Israel, that committed the crime, to investigate its own crime. This is what we're getting from the word. So it's very frustrating. And the Israeli finance minister is also, approving plans. Now Netanyahu there was a proposal by an Israeli MK to shut down Al Jazeera, so a media blackout, and then Israel's finance minister, Smotrich, approving a plan to cut financial ties with Palestinian banks, and this includes Gaza. So there is no liquidity in the market, and you cannot find cash. This is another struggle for people now. Things are expensive, crazy expensive.
So I just want to, just for listeners' benefits now, we can add financial terrorism to ecocide, to domicide, to genocide, and on and on and on it goes.
Well, the, you know, the Israelis have a name for this. They call it the Dahir Doctrine, after what they tried to do in the southern suburbs of Beirut in 2006, which is destroy a whole city and a whole infrastructure as a way of rebuilding the credibility of the Israeli military deterrent. I mean,
yes, they're dreaming about creating a deterrence in Gaza, but now they have created an enemy in every single household in the city after killing more than 32,000 Palestinians. And
amongst Palestinians everywhere, let's remember, like, look at those huge protests in Jordan, throughout Jordan, which is a strong U.S. ally. I mean, Palestinians everywhere are not going to be, you know, cowed and intimidated and deterred by what's going on.
Absolutely. I would like to end the conversation here today. Thank you very much, Tony and Helena, for your insights and thoughts and for the discussions and the questions. I would like to thank our co-sponsors, the Hashim Sani Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Malaya, and looking forward for yet another conversation with you guys next week.